Fortitude or Earth.
Welcome back to Fortitude, everyone. J.W. Wilson. And today we have a special guest who has an amazing story we're going to share, Mr. Bill Arnold. Mr. Bill, thank you for joining us today
on the
show.
It's a pleasure. Good to see you today. Thank you for having me.
I can't tell you how I've been following you for a while. I've known your story, and to meet you in person is just an honor, so I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's start from maybe the beginning, if we can.
Okay.
Well, before we get to the beginning, you were 28 years a teacher. You taught history. You coached football, baseball. You worked as an administrator at local Country Day. My big rival from Trinity Valley.
Mutual respect between our two schools, right? I have a lot of admiration, a lot of good friends. My wife's a Trinity Valley alum, so
this is what I've heard.
Very proud of that.
Love to hear how you guys met here shortly. You're an alumni there, so that was maybe an easy tie. Your mom started teaching, you told me, in seventh grade.
Correct.
So you came from All Saints to Country Day.
That's right.
There's a story that one of your friends might have shared. Apparently, you were a baseball player, and maybe this story's legend, maybe it's not, but the way I was explaining it, you hit a home run, a walk-off home run to win a game, a certain game at Country Day that kind of puts you up in the lore. Of Country Day.
I may have done that. I can't.
You don't remember?
I think that there may be some truth to that.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't know who your friends are.
Fair enough. From Country Day, you went off to VMI, Virginia Military Institute, part of the ROTC program.
That's correct. Right? I was a Marine scholar there.
Marine scholar. You graduated from there, went in straight into the Marines for your time. 4 years, 90 to 94, the Marines.
Right.
Can you tell us a little about that time in the Marines?
Sure.
The first stint.
Yeah, sure. Once I graduated from VMI in May of 90, I went and spent 6 months in Quantico, Virginia at the basic school. Mm-hmm. After the conclusion of that, my wife and I got married. Debbie and I married in December of 1990. I spent 4 months in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and that's where all Marine and Army armor officers trained. So mm-hmm. I trained to be a tank commander. Okay. And in May of 91, I took command of a tank platoon at Camp Pendleton, California. And let's see, Debbie and I spent a year and a half in Camp Pendleton, and then 2.5 years in 29 Palms, California, which is a desert training facility about an hour and a half east of Palm Springs.
Mm-hmm. You're serving your time roughly about 4 years.
Correct.
Then about the age of 26, you decided that, your service, I guess it ended. There was no conflict currently at that time.
Correct.
You decided, I'm going to go back. Hey, why not? I'm going to go back to Country Day and teach.
Well, it wasn't quite that simple. What happened was when Debbie went to college in Massachusetts, I was in Virginia. And when we got married, neither one of us knew a whole lot about the military. Mm-hmm. And so I made the promise to her that at the end of my four-year commitment, she would make the decision whether it was best for our family. Well, I didn't know I would love it as much as I did. Mm-hmm. But she said, look, I want to move back to Fort Worth and raise a family. We had a young son at that time. And so made some applications. Knew I wanted to be a teacher because my mother was a lifelong teacher. And Country Day offered me a fantastic job teaching in the upper school and doing some coaching. So. Mm-hmm. That's how I ended up back here in Fort Worth.
And you're a history teacher, correct?
That's correct. I taught 8 or 9 different history courses while I was there. I served in various administrative roles, admissions, mm-hmm. development. I was head of the upper school, and I was also the director of strategic initiatives at the school.
And you had three kids at that point? You had raised three kids?
All so three of my children have graduated from Country Day,
very
and
nice.
Now they're all out of college.
Right. So you're going along, you're teaching. I got to believe you're having a ball with it. This is where you're meant to be.
It was
2001. September 11th happens.
Yeah, you know, like so many folks, I was teaching that morning, and a colleague came in and said, "Have you heard what's happening?" And that started. It changed my life, just like it changed the lives of so many. Mm-hmm. I got home from school that evening, and we were like millions and millions of Americans, or millions of people all over the world, were watching the television. And it was actually Debbie. We were sitting on the bed. She leaned over and she said, "You were a really good Marine." And you know, like I say, like so many people, we did an inventory of our skills, right, mm-hmm. and our passions too. And made the decision that night that I would try to figure out how to get back in the Marines.
Right.
And it was, a week or two later, I contacted a prior service recruiter, and the only job that was available for a tank officer was in Amarillo, Texas. And so I took command of a reserve scout platoon. It was a reconnaissance platoon up in Amarillo. And, at that point, 2002, I was back in and would later go on to deploy. I did a combat tour in the Anbar province in 2004 and 2005.
Before we get into the meat of the story here,
yeah,
what is, for those who don't know, is it possible to tell us what is it like to be in a tank and ride a tank, command a tank battalion? Is there a way to describe it?
Yeah,
to
yeah, it's I didn't do that in Iraq, but when I was a lieutenant and a captain, I trained on an M60A1 tank, which is an old Vietnam era tank. We transitioned to the M1A1 Abrams, which most people are familiar with, and. And one of the things that I really enjoyed and found invigorating about commanding tanks is that it's a combination of tactics. Mm-hmm. It's a combination of leadership, obviously, of your Marines, but you also have this behemoth. And quite frankly, it was something that I was not really familiar with was how these machines worked. And one of the things that I enjoyed as much as anything is learning how to operate these vehicles. And so it was thrilling, dangerous, but thrilling. And it was really a positive tour for me.
So you just mentioned in 2004, the Iraq situation comes to light.
Right.
You're sent over commander of Scout Battalion Regimental Combat Team Number 1. Did I get that right?
Yeah, Scout Platoon Regimental Combat Team 1.
Yes, sir.
Right.
So you're no longer in the tank, but you're commanding a group.
We were in Humvees.
Humvees.
Right?
How many people in the platoon?
I had 27 Marines, one Navy corpsman who's a medic, phenomenal young man who provided wonderful service to us. And the way we were organized, we had 8 Humvees, and some of the Humvees had heavy machine guns. Some of them had anti-tank guided missiles on them. And our primary mission, at least we thought before we got there, was that we were going to do long-range reconnaissance, screening security operations for the infantry. But by the time we got there, we took on an additional duty, which was to serve as the commanding officer of Regimental Combat Team 1. We were his personal security detachment.
Okay.
And so, not to get too far into the weeds, but when commanders command their forces in battle, they have to get there safely.
Truly.
And and also the way Marine colonels operate, we were... engaged in very, very, very heavy combat while we were there.
Are you entering the war zone through Kuwait?
We flew. We actually trained 8 weeks in California at 29 Palms. We boarded a United Airlines 747 and flew, from March Air Force Base to Frankfurt, Germany. We refueled our airplane there, landed in Kuwait City.
Okay.
And then we took... it was over a several day period. We flew on C-130s from Kuwait City to a large Iraqi airbase called Al Asad. We landed there, got on trucks, and then spent 4 or 5 hour road march to Fallujah.
Fallujah, and this is where it gets
That's correct.
Not to diminish anything before that or after that, but that's where it really gets heavy.
Correct. Yeah, there were a couple of battles in Fallujah. One in April of 2004. And the one I participated in kicked off in early November of 2004.
Right. So can you tell us the story of Fallujah and the way I've heard I've heard it online before, but it's compelling stuff, man.
Yeah, I think any of your viewers could Google Second Battle of Fallujah, and there's everything that you would want to find out. But our particular role was to provide not only combat support for infantry Marines that were going into battle, because we did have heavy machine guns and we had other assets, but also to take our commander to a point of his choosing to where he can most effectively command that battle. And so the battle commenced early morning of, well, it was late, I guess, trying to do the math in Fort Worth, but we executed our first movement into the city on the 8th of November, about 6:45 in the morning. Now, the battle itself was at the time, was sort of, it focused the world's attention. The challenge, Fallujah is located about 35 miles west of Baghdad.
Right.
And if you could get in your time machine and go back and sort of visit what was going on in Baghdad at that time, the insurgent forces were doing a really brutal job of disrupting coalition activities, primarily through suicide car bombs. Well, our intelligence had indicated that Fallujah was where most of those car bombs were being assembled. It was also important strategically because it was the sort of the home base of, at that time, other than Osama bin Laden, the world's most notorious terrorist, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was very famous for beheadings and right, photographing those and things like that. And so essentially what the Marine Corps wanted to do was to destroy those enemy forces in Fallujah to prevent the car bombings, but also to help establish legitimate governance within the city.
Right.
And so for, you know, between November the 8th and, well, we successfully were able to help the Iraqi people hold their first elections in January. Right. Of 05. So what was that? A couple of months of really intense kinetic combat.
We're talking about fighting in the in the streets of a city. Not these are these aren't on the field.
Yeah,
right?
it was not what most people think when they think of Iraq. In fact, Fallujah was the largest urban battle that the United States had fought in since, I guess, Way City in Vietnam. And so, and urban combat is particularly challenging. Because the battlefield itself is being fought in rubbled streets, it's being fought in multi-story buildings, but it's also being fought underground.
Right.
And the insurgent forces that occupied the city, I don't know, they were probably 3,500 or so really hardcore fighters that were there, had been there for a significant amount of time, so they were able to prepare a very complex defensive belt that had not only IEDs and rockets and trenches and anyway, it was a tough fight for a lot of folks. We lost, while I was there, our regiment, I believe, or total 90 killed and about 800 were wounded there.
Is this the Operation Phantom Fury?
Phantom Fury, that's
six
right.
Week battle.
That's right. Yeah. It was originally called Phantom Fury, but at the behest of the Prime Minister of Iraq, or the interim Prime Minister at the time, Ayad Alawi, he changed it to Al-Fajr, which in Arabic means the dawn, and that was the message that he wanted to send. It was a new dawn for Anbar, or at least that was what he hoped.
Right. The weapons you encountered, you mentioned IEDs. Are these insurgents? Are they heavily armed? Are they? I know there's lots of explosives and cars and things we all see in the news, but how do they typically fight?
Yeah, that's a good question. Most of the insurgent forces that we fought against in the early days of the battle, they were mainly groups of 10 or less hunter-killer teams. Four or five insurgents would be armed with AK-47s. Sometimes they would have light machine guns. And then one of the most ubiquitous weapons of that conflict was the RPG-7.
Right.
And so whenever we engaged them, you know, I can't think of a time where it didn't involve rifle fire, machine gun fire, but also rockets as well. And then, of course, the IEDs were all over the place as well.
I read a story about you somewhere a few weeks ago, but in preparation for this, you'd gone a certain period of time in uniform where you hadn't either hadn't changed clothes in a week. Week's time or something to that effect. recall?
Yeah, I think once the battle commenced, we were not able to get back for showers for 17 days. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'd never experienced combat before. So, you know, it's like a football team that's never been in a game. Once you get hit, punched in the mouth,
yeah,
you don't really know how you're going to react. And the time, just, it all ran together. And so I don't know. I don't recall taking my boots off for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Probably.
Yeah.
Which is not a good thing for me or anybody else, mm-hmm. but it was a stressful time.
Yes, sir. Bill, you strike me as a very calm, calculated, intelligent, thoughtful person. My honest opinion, is this the type of person you are when you're over there commanding? I mean, honestly, it's a different situation.
Yeah.
We're not in harm's way here, but is this the type of leader that you are?
Yeah, I think we are who we are in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think authentic leadership is the only kind of leadership, mm-hmm. ultimately, that's effective.
Right.
And the platoon that I commanded, extraordinary group of guys. One of the things that's unique about reserve units, they tend to be older.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to have families, life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall ever even raising my voice
really with
the scouts. I always felt that a sort of a decisive and fatherly mm-hmm. tone worked best for them, and I think it was effective. You'd have to ask them.
Yes, sir.
But I have had some tell me that they appreciated mm-hmm. that I never tried to be someone that I'm not.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about this a few times prior to today. You've seen, obviously, things that most of us never will or should. But you were there. Is it difficult to talk about it at some length? I mean, obviously, you're sharing your story. We're grateful for it, but is it hard to talk about?
Sometimes, but generally not. Those mm-hmm. those that know me well know that I'll talk about it a lot. And the reason I do that is I think it's important for two reasons. One, we know it's good for me mm-hmm. to tell the story. But in another sense, folks like you or anybody, your listeners, your audience needs to hear mm-hmm. about, and I'm talking about me. I can only provide my story.
Right.
But veteran stories are something that we all need to learn from,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in a democracy, because waging of war is something that mm-hmm. all of us shouldn't do unless it's absolutely necessary.
Yes,
so
indeed.
So for that reason, mm-hmm. I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I like to educate folks, and I happen to have experienced combat.
I appreciate that. Your experience, the retake of Fallujah, obviously you're making ground slowly but surely.
Right.
6 weeks it lasted. During this time, are you thinking of Debbie and the kids? Do you have time to think about that? Do you have time to consider your own safety and health, or is it just training regimen kicks in?
Yeah, I was so blessed. I'm so blessed to have an extraordinarily smart, beautiful, talented wife and educator in Debbie. And quite frankly, I have so much confidence in her capabilities. In many ways, that freed me up to be able to focus.
Mm-hmm.
We did have a satellite telephone, an Iridium phone, that was meant to be used for tactical communication. But one of the things that I did is I allowed the Marines to make one 10-minute phone call a week,
mm-hmm.
if the situation permitted it. And occasionally I would call home. I can't recall exactly, probably 10 times throughout the deployment I was able to call home. I did send a few emails, but there was just very little. I had a job to do. And ironically, Debbie appreciated the fact that I had a job to do, and she didn't want to
mm-hmm.
cloud my mind, because it's very difficult. One of the things I think modern warriors in general, but particularly in a modern age with communication, it is really hard to live in two worlds. And it's hard to draft an attack plan and execute that attack plan if you also know that the washing machine's broken and your child has the stomach bug and all those kinds of things. I've seen Marines try to negotiate that, and it's dangerous to do that. So we tried to as best we could as a family say, you know what, Dad will be home, and mm-hmm. we'll connect then. He's got work to do.
That's an interesting take. To appreciate you sharing that. The 6 week Fallujah recovery or retake is happening. When did you learn that it was successful? I mean, retrospectively, you got to the end of that particular event. How did that end for you? How did you find out that it was? You'd gotten to where the mission
was
complete.
I was right at the front of it. So, you know, when we got to the southern part of the city, the attack was essentially north-south. Mm-hmm. For pheasant hunters out there, know that you start at the top of the field and you gradually walk, and those mm-hmm. pheasants all get to the end of the row before they fly, and the insurgents fought that way. And so they put forth a very vigorous defense in depth, and by the time we reached the southern part of the city, that's where the real teeth of the insurgent defenses were, just because they had fallen back and they were crushed and destroyed there. But I knew, of course, winning and losing is opaque, right, particularly in Iraq, but I knew we were winning on the 23rd or 4th of December, when the first civilians were allowed back into the city. Which was a very proud day for us. Tough day, because we were worried about infiltration from the insurgent forces, but that was a great day for us. And then, of course, my proudest day probably in Iraq was the 30th of January, when 7,000 voters cast ballots for the first time in their lives. I happened to be at one polling place, and I forget, the voting started at 7 in the morning or 8, mm-hmm. I can't remember. And that time, it clicked, and nobody was out. Well, JW, the first person to come out and walk down the street to go to the polling spot was a woman. Mm. And that was not lost on me. Because I teach government, right? I was a government teacher. And so seeing that woman cast that ballot and walk out, she walked out after she had cast her ballot, and they would ink your thumb, your finger. And I'll never forget seeing her with that purple ink on her finger. Mm-hmm. And really, for the first time, perhaps, I thought really good about what we were doing there.
Wonderful. The people in general, did you get to feel any appreciation from them for what you'd been through and done?
Not a lot.
Not a lot.
Occasionally, Fallujah residents are very xenophobic, mm-hmm. And have been for centuries for lots of complicated reasons. They did not happen to see us as liberators in Fallujah. Mm-hmm. And so there was not a whole lot of gratitude shown. Although, you know, there were times, because several thousand of the buildings had been destroyed. And so when families came back in, mm-hmm. and they would go to where their home was, sometimes it was destroyed, sometimes it wasn't. And so one of the things that was very important to the colonel I worked for was to go and visit with these families. We had a wonderful interpreter named Mohammed, who I talked to on WhatsApp a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. He's in Erbil, Iraq, working for a humanitarian group. But what we would do is we'd visit with them, and we had some cash to give them to try to help them rebuild. And of course, the little children tended to be friendly. Of course, you needed to take your helmet off and put your rifle down and mm-hmm. smile. And sometimes, but by and large, it was not a friendly crowd.
How, after that Fallujah fell to the Allies, how much longer were you over there?
Let's see. I was there until April. So, I think it's accurate to say Fallujah fell, but that doesn't mean that the combat stopped.
Right.
It was constant because mm-hmm. Just sort of the nature of the conflict. There wasn't a day that went by that there wasn't gunfire, rocket, or mortar fire, even though the battle itself had sort of ended. Mm-hmm. But let's put a date on it. Let's say January 30th, end of it. I would fly home on the 4th or 5th of April.
Okay.
So I was there a little bit afterward.
You so every day though, are you moving on from Fallujah to another spot? Are you
No.
staying in Fallujah?
Yeah, we stayed there.
To keep the peace?
Yeah, yeah, yes.
Okay.
In fact, the commander of 1st Marines, who I worked with, sort of de facto became the mayor.
Okay.
And so his responsibilities, all of our responsibilities, went from kinetic destruction of the enemy to humanitarian assistance, and then finally to reconstruction of the city. Mm-hmm. So things like the electrical grid, fresh water, the water pumps that pump the water out of the city into the Euphrates, healthcare, medical treatment, anything the Fort Worth city manager would have to do, mm-hmm. if our city was destroyed, that's what the punch list looked like for the CEO of First Marines.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Yeah, now we had the assistance of a combat support group. We also had a tremendous young man named Cale Weston, who was the State Department rep, mm-hmm. and he helped us with the liaison between the governing tribal councils. And,
right.
But it was the reconstruction was something that was a real challenge.
For some reason, I always think of when we see the movies and news, the nighttime being just terrifying. Is nighttime worse than daytime for the obvious reason, or can you describe it nighttime during?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we conducted about 200 nighttime operations. Obviously, it's frightening because you lose one of your senses.
Right.
But there wasn't a whole lot of fighting that went on at night after probably the second week. And I think that's for two reasons. One, the insurgents were aware of the fact that we had a technological mm-hmm. advantage. Mm-hmm. We had night vision. We had thermal imaging systems. We had aircraft patrolling 24/7 with infrared and thermal. And so they learned not to come out at night.
Right.
To the same degree as they did earlier. The second thing is, and I have no proof of this, obviously, but everyone was so exhausted. And the operational tempo of the battle was so fast that I think the insurgents needed time to sleep.
Sure.
And so after a couple of weeks, it seems as though the kinetic, the gunfire was much less.
This may be a silly question, but would you ever have a desire to go back to Fallujah, assuming it's safe? I know it still has its issues.
Could arrange a flight, I'll go tomorrow.
Please explain.
Well, I'm a teacher. I want to see.
Mm.
I used to take students on walking tours of the Normandy battlefield in France, one of the things I got to do at Country Day a lot. And I always felt jealous of the veterans. Not that they had to fight on Normandy, that's not what I'm suggesting, mm-hmm. but to be able to go back and tour those fields or see people that they may have known or where their friends, you know, were killed or something like that was something that I've always wanted to do. Plus, I would love to meet my friend Muhammad in Fallujah with my iPhone and interview those folks.
Oh, wow.
I would love to tell them my perspective, mm-hmm. but I would love to get their perspective. Of course I would go.
That would be amazing.
Of course I would go.
I hope that one day you can accomplish that.
I do too. I do too. Now, I don't know if my family wants me to go back.
Right,
and that's the role they play.
Yes, sir.
But I would definitely go back.
One of the things I saw about you that I read, you were the fifth generation of your family to go to combat.
I think that's correct. Not necessarily combat, but in the service, in a war.
In a war, excuse
right.
me. In a war.
Right.
Great-great-grandfather fought in the Civil War.
Correct.
Holy cow.
Right.
Do we know what side?
Well, I think we had one on both sides.
On both sides?
Yeah.
Your father fought in World War II.
He did. He was in the Navy. Was on board a destroyer escort. The war ended while he was at sea, but he served with the occupation forces mm-hmm. In Yokosuka, Japan.
Okay.
And helped sort of that demobilization before he shipped him home.
So you have some other, who else can we talk about in this generational?
Well, he's the only one I know of. We have relatives that fought in the Spanish-American War in 1890s. My grandfather, Ross Arnold, who I never knew, he died in 1942, mm-hmm. Was an American soldier in France during World War I.
It's impressive.
And I've only ever seen one photograph of him, but it was not a war picture.
So your combat deployment ends. You're roughly 45 years old, if my math.
No, let's say I'm 56 now. So that was 20 years ago. I was 37, I think, when I came home. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but still twice as old as a lot of the Marines. Right.
A lot of people talking about you may not know what they're talking about. You returned to civilian life.
I did.
Back to Country Day. He couldn't leave it alone, which is wonderful.
No, well, I loved my job.
Indeed. The challenge is going from that to Country Day teaching again.
Yeah, there were some challenges. Fortunately, I came back in April, and the head of school at the time, Evan Peterson, a man whom I greatly admire, said, don't set foot on campus. I also had, legally, I had 30 days before I had to return to my job. But you know what we did? Every morning, Debbie and I walked down to the Trinity Trail, right across from your office.
Mm-hmm.
Every single morning for a month, 2 months. And it was a really good opportunity for us to reconnect.
Wow.
But it was challenging because, you know, in modern times we have, particularly in the United States, I think, is we fight our wars without a lot of shared suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, thank God the United States or Fort Worth hasn't sustained any capital damage due to, well, certainly September 11th. And so what happens when a veteran returns home, everyone's grateful for their service, but they don't know what it's been like.
Sure.
And it was a challenge. Mm-hmm. It was almost I was almost dizzy when I came back. But certainly by the time school started in September or August, I'd been home 3 or 4 months and I was ready to roll.
I got to imagine that the kids in your class, they want to talk about battle, or do they know enough to ask those questions?
Well, they did, and you know, the war affected my teaching. I mean, in a good way, from the standpoint of I was able to contribute to the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause one of the things that I did was I taught an elective course for juniors and seniors called the Middle East in Transition. And so when I got home, I'd studied it so much. I tried to learn everything I could about it before we went. I thought, a keen observer of the culture, you know, where we were, the people, the politics, and so forth. So when I came back, I put a proposal to the curriculum committee that I teach a course on the Middle East. And I did that. I taught that for many, mm-hmm. many, many years. And it started kind of 1979 Islamic Revolution all the way up to, you know, sort of the present day. And so I was able to contribute. My war experience and all the preparation in front of that enabled me to, quite frankly, teach a course that nobody else could teach, mm-hmm. so simply because I was the sort of the expert on it when I came back. But the war experience, I think it affected my teaching in other ways too. It made me much more appreciative for what I had. You know, context is so important. And so I think I was probably changed a little bit, JW. Simply, things didn't bother me as much, maybe.
The little things in life, being late to something.
You know, there's something magical about a clean pair of socks. But you can't appreciate a clean pair of socks unless you haven't had a clean pair of socks, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, sir.
And I think that was a good thing. Mm-hmm. Particularly the students that I were teaching, because
mm-hmm.
We all do it now, and I've reverted back to it. We tend to complain about things that we really shouldn't,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to say, well, it's not as bad, you know, as you think. So, yeah, there are a lot of different ways. But if you interviewed my students, they would probably say there are a lot of stories in there,
right?
Because there are a lot of lessons I learned,
right. Well, Bill, I did a couple of them actually. It's funny. No. I'm glad you said that. You teed me up perfectly. Well, I've known of you. We're generally uh-huh. in the same age demographic. Yeah. Maybe you're a little older, but
yeah.
A lot of these kids that I know, and you know, being a Trinity Valley, I've heard your name throughout the last 10, 20 years of my life. You're a lot of people's favorite teacher.
Well, that's
I don't
nice.
Know if you know that.
No,
I assume you know
nice.
Something,
it's
but
nice.
you are often referred to as someone's best teacher they ever had. That's nice. Pretty cool.
It's thoughtful.
I think you should know that because
thank you for sharing.
Yeah, I mean you deserve to know that.
Thank you.
Get a little emotional telling you that. Like that's a cool thing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Moving on along from that, you started running marathons, or you started running at least. Was that after effect of?
No, I did that when I was in college. I haven't always run.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in a little running group at VMI, and we ran marathons. I actually haven't run one since '97. So, my thing now, and when I came back, one of the first things my doctor told me, and it's things we all know, he says you need to go outside for at least 2 hours a day. You'll feel better. Mm-hmm. Duh, right? Well, one of the things, my favorite thing to do now is backpack and hike.
Oh, nice.
And I've done, I don't know, about 1,000 miles of the Appalachian Trail.
Okay.
In little segments. I didn't do it all at once, but I've walked most of the way from Georgia. This summer I finished in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. So I've made it, I'm about halfway up. So my goal is before I die, to finish that trail.
So you'll do a section, then come home and come back to a
section.
Yeah, no, later.
Usually in the summer I'll walk. This summer I walked 150 something miles.
That's incredible.
It was great.
Well done.
What I do for physical fitness.
It's one of the best things. Another thing I know you love to read. Some of your friends told me that you can't read enough. You're well read. I can tell by the way we're discussing certain things, but you love to read.
I do.
I think that's a pretty cool thing, not just because you can speak about lots of things, but people that you're teaching, these kids, reading isn't such a big thing as it used to be, or maybe it's a problem, but
no.
People that get to know you and get to be taught by you and know that you like to read, it's a pretty powerful tool. Why are books so important to you?
Well, you know, JW, I didn't really like to read till I was an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But part of my job, it's a professional responsibility to devour as much content as you possibly can. I think your best teachers, they can answer those third level questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can answer that first level, and most can answer that second level, but that's the real learning takes place with depth.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one way to get it. Mm-hmm. you gotta read, and I love to read now. I'm curious about lots of things.
Being curious, I think, is an awesome answer. You won a Baird Friedman Award.
I did.
What was that like?
It was a great honor.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a great honor. I remember that night well. A lot of folks came in. You know, I befriended about 6 or 7 years before he died Jim Wright,
mm-hmm.
Congressman from Fort Worth. And
right.
Toward the end of his life, he and I had what I considered to be a close friendship. We didn't talk about politics. We just talked about life and his service in war and so forth. And he was gracious enough to come back and speak at that. I was very proud
really
of that.
Really neat. Well, congrats. Yeah. That's a really distinct
thank you.
Baird Friedman Hero Award for sure. I wanted to ask you this question. There's a gentleman who you know, we all know well. The story is grown and grown, but Pat Tillman's story.
Absolutely.
It's not the same, but it does have some similarities in your story as well from leaving. But do you guys have any, I mean, is there any thoughts on that particular human being that you can share?
Well, I mean, no, I didn't know him.
Right.
I was inspired by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of us, we all need to be inspired.
Sure.
And if we don't, if it doesn't come naturally, we should look for it. And his, you know, leaving the NFL and joining the U.S. Army and obviously his untimely death in Afghanistan was tragic. But, you know, lots of us talk about what we should do. Pat Tillman did it.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's Pat Tillman or other people like that,
right.
That inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
That inspires me. So, yeah.
You and I probably know a lot of people in this regard, but most people in our general life, they're earning a living. They're going after that dollar, making that dollar, that next dollar. It's part of the economic system of
sure.
our country. But you strike me as someone quite different. You're more of the service nature guy, I would believe. You taught. You served the military. You serve the veterans here. We'll talk about that in a second. But you seem to be wired differently than most folks. You're not after riches and wealth and fame. You're after a purpose, meaning. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think a couple of thoughts on that. One is, I've always believed, and I actually heard it this past weekend, but we don't own anything, JW. We're stewards of everything, right? I mean,
is there a message in there somewhere? Well, yes.
I hope so,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, I know you had a wonderful career on the football team at TCU, but you were one player on a continuum, right? And I think the more of us that sort of thought in those terms, mm-hmm. A, we'd be a lot happier. And I think we would also, I don't know, conduct ourselves differently if we understood that, you know, we're part of a long line of folks that came before us. There'll be a lot of folks after us. But the second thing I wanted to point out, and I want to make sure that you understand that, yes, I've been a teacher, yes, I've been a Marine, and yes, I run a nonprofit, but I do it because I love it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not afraid to admit that. When I loved being a Marine, I loved being a school teacher, I love my time with veterans now, so it's not entirely altruistic. It's kind of selfish in a lot of ways. I get as much energy out mm-hmm. of the things that I've done as I suspect that the folks that I've served. Does that
Love
make
it.
Sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Thank
so
you
that's,
for sharing that. Yeah. This nonprofit you speak of, Blue Diamond Recreation, you're the executive director currently.
Yeah.
You've given up the teaching profession.
I did.
And then now you're helping vets and their families.
I am. About 2 years ago, I was traveling home from Borger, Texas. I'd been to a funeral mm-hmm. of one of the Marines that I'd commanded in Iraq. And our platoon has not been immune to the suicide epidemic that we should all be aware of. Mm-hmm. Over 20 veterans a day are taking their lives. But by the time I got home on that five-hour journey, I decided how I wanted to spend the third of my professional career, and it was to help vets. Doesn't mean I don't still love teaching. Absolutely love teaching. I love Fort Worth Country Day and the wonderful schools here in Fort Worth, but I made the decision that I sort of got called in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I thought, okay, what do I wish I had had when I got home from Iraq? And my entire model for Blue Diamond Recreation is built around the things that I wished I had had. And so the mission of Blue Diamond is to provide restorative recreational opportunities for veterans and their families challenged by the effects of war. Mm-hmm. Very broad. Because we're all challenged in different ways, and we could list 10,000 recreational programs. But the key to it is once I hear of a veteran, or once I learn, or veterans referred to me, the first step is to get to know them.
Right.
Veterans often don't want to talk to you. Mm. They have to trust you. They have to respect you. You have to be able to listen to them. I mean, God gave us one mouth, two ears, right? I mean, for a reason. And one of the skills I think I developed as a teacher is I'll listen. And once you get to know the individual, and then what we'll do is we'll build a program that they will enjoy. Maybe mm-hmm. it's something they enjoyed doing prior to their wounding. Maybe it's something they've always wanted to do. And then we go on a trip. It might be backpacking in Big Bend. We went skydiving this past weekend.
Okay.
I took a family to study whales in Massachusetts. I've got lots of vets like to go hunting. Mm-hmm. So we do hunts and so forth. But while we're on our trip, I do something else. I video interview them. We participate in a program at the Library of Congress called the Veterans History Project. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I tell the veteran is I say, look, we owe it to the future. we need you to tell your story. And oftentimes they're like, no. They don't want to do it because they think they didn't do anything important or nobody would want to hear them. But that's part of it. So I sit and I interview them, kind of like we're doing now, hour, 2 hour interview. And then once we've completed our adventure, I sit down and I watch that and I go through it for clues. Mm-hmm. And you can pick up, you can find the heartache, you can find the pain, you can find a need. And then just like anything in life, the follow through is the most important part.
Yes, sir.
And I'm not a therapist, but there's a lot of organizations out there. But if I can learn what you need or what you might not know you need, mm-hmm. I'll help you get it. And so been doing it 18 months now. It's tougher than I thought. Of course, there's a fundraising aspect to any nonprofit.
How can they help?
Well, there's three ways, JW. One is you can go to my website, bluediamondrecreation.com, and there's a donate button. We always need financial support. The second thing is you can go to my YouTube channel, mm-hmm. And subscribe to it. And that's sort of a repository for some of the interviews. The other thing that I'm doing on my YouTube channel is I'm reading my war diary in chapters. Okay. I wrote a little book in 2017 for my kids. It was unpublished. But over the last several years, a lot of folks that have really encouraged me to share that story. And so what I'm doing on my YouTube channel, you know, maybe once a week, every other week, whenever mm-hmm. I feel like it, I'm reading that war journal. So people, they can learn about me and they can learn what we're doing. But here's the third thing we need folks to do. Refer. If you know somebody that's hurting, mm-hmm. if you know a veteran that needs anything, it doesn't matter what it is, if they need something, call me. Send me an email. I might not be able to help them, mm-hmm. but I will give 100% trying to find people that will.
We will put that out on the social media and the end of
great.
The show.
Great, that would
well.
Be wonderful.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any heroes in your life? Any people you wanted to be like growing up?
Oh,
still?
For sure. My father. I guess a lot of young boys feel that way. He passed in 1996. He was a hero. A lot of my boyhood heroes were book characters, and they tended to all be military men mm-hmm. and women. But Yeah, there's certain, you know, I think one of the things that I encourage young people to do, because occasionally they're like, oh, I want to be a leader. How do I be a leader? And I said, well, look, identify somebody in your life that possesses the qualities that you think leaders should have, and then just try to be like them
right.
until you develop your own mm-hmm. style, which we all do over time.
Right.
But we got to emulate somebody mm-hmm. at the beginning.
Yes.
And my dad was somebody. He was that person for
Very
me.
Very nice. You have a favorite book you've ever read?
Oh, gosh. yeah. You know, I mainly read nonfiction. But I think I probably, if I were stranded on a desert island, I'd probably take Lonesome Dove.
All right. Well done.
Why not?
Well done. You have 30 years of marriage to this wonderful lady named Debbie. You have two grandkids now, told me. Your three kids are now grown and giving you grandkids, apparently.
Right.
Awesome job. I really appreciate you sharing your story today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Before we go, we always ask our guests this particular question. Marital affairs and kids, all the things associated with family, familial affairs aside, marital affairs sound a little tricky, but familial affairs aside, do you have a best day of your whole life?
Best day of my whole life. Absolutely. August 8th, 1988. It's the first date I had with Debbie.
It might be considered the familial thing, but...
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's a pretty good one.
I wasn't listening. What I told you,
it's okay.
To
okay. Yes, okay.
But the other... there's some irony here too, but I think it's true. November the 8th, 2004, when the battle started, I was keenly aware. I remember having this thought in my head as we drove out in the darkness that I had fulfilled a lifelong dream. I'd always wanted to command Marines in battle, and I was doing it. So that was also a great day.
Bill Arnold, thank you for the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to thank David Rasko and John Bonnell, friends, for help setting this up. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
That's been another episode of Fortitude. Thank you for watching. Boom. Fortitude.